NPR host Peter Sagal. You know Peter Sagal is the host of the NPR News quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which airs Saturday at 10 and Sundays at 3 here on Maine Public Radio. Nationally, it's the most popular show on public radio. What you might not know about Peter Sagal is that he's a devoted runner and has run 14 marathons. In fact, he's written a book about all that called The Incomplete Book of Running. Part memoir, part humor, and part reflective essay, Sagal opens up about a difficult time in his life. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Peter Sagal is our guest. Are you a fan of Wait, Wait? Do you have a question about the show, or the guests, or Peter? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. I'm willing to bet a good number of you listening to this show also listened to a very popular NPR show this weekend, the show that covers news events, important cultural happenings, and has a very talented host. But if you didn't happen to hear Lulu Garcia-Navarro on Weekend Edition Sunday, well, we have the next best thing, Peter Sagal, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and the author of the new book, The Incomplete Book of Running. Peter joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. And as always, we want to hear from you. Who is your favorite Wait, Wait panelist? Are you a regular listener? What have you always wanted to know? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Peter, how are you today?
I'm well. Now I'm bitter about Lulu Garcia-Navarro. But you've just added flame to our lifelong rivalry.
Oh, really?
So, you know.
Okay, I
shall be victorious someday.
Someday. Well, I think there are a lot of people who think you're victorious. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me celebrated 20 years on the air just last year. And what I want to know is, after all this time, is it still as fun as it seems, or are you guys just pretending?
No, let me put it this way. If we pretended to have fun, we would have failed and vanished into the ether a long time ago. A lot of people come up and say to me, they sound like you're having fun, and we genuinely are. I think if you want to get analytical about it, I think that's why the show is as popular as it is, because you are hearing a bunch of people genuinely enjoying themselves. And that, if anything, is the key to our success. So, yeah, it's still fun.
So tell us some inside scoop on the regulars. For example, can you tell us something nobody knows about Paula Poundstone?
Here's the funny thing. You can't tell people something they don't know about Paula Poundstone, because Paula Poundstone will tell you everything herself. That's sort of her brand. I've never met anybody who's less withholding. But actually, I should tell two things about Paula, which is that, first of all, she doesn't really annoy me. We kind of play that up for comic effect. We're actually dear friends. And the second thing is she's actually, when she's not on stage and talking about how crazy her life is and how annoying everything is and some bizarre experience she had having extraordinary difficulty doing a typical thing, she's out there doing a lot of good works. Like, people may not know this, but she volunteers, I think, 3 times a week at an old age home. She just goes over and talks to people. She adopted 3 kids out of the L.A. foster system, kids who had no place else to go. She's actually a kind of a wonderfully decent human being who kind of puts me to shame, to tell you the truth. Now I feel kind of bad about myself again.
This was not the point of inviting you onto Maine Calling.
I know. But... I'm not as nice. I'm not as smart as Lulu Garcia-Navarro. I'm not as nice as Paula Poundstone. Anyway.
So I'm wondering, though, you know, it's a news quiz show, and I'm wondering, do you ever think to yourself, the news isn't funny this week. How are we going to do this show?
Oh, no, never. Jeez, why would that ever come up? No, we actually
I think I'd be in
a
panic attack all the time.
Yeah, well, after a while, you sort of get used to anything. We see ourselves, to be serious for a second, at Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, as really having one job, which is to cheer people up. Specifically, cheer them up about the week's news. So if something terrible has happened in the week's news, and by that I usually mean things like natural disasters or terrible crimes, our job is to, for at least an hour, get people's mind off it. And, you know, we know that people like Lulu Garcia Navarro or Scott Simon or you know, Audie Cornish or all the other wonderful people at NPR, yourself included, will provide people the actual information they need to make sense of whatever terrible thing has happened. That's not our job. Our job is to give you a break for an hour, telling fart jokes and describing bizarre animals that people stuffed into their pants. Sometimes, though, the top of the news is very distressing. I think people might understand what I'm talking about. And we feel an obligation to kind of directly, you know, address that and try to find, if you will, the lighter side of it. And that's something we take fairly seriously. And I think something that people respond to, at least they do when they talk to me about it.
I understand you tape Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on Thursday nights. As a lifelong news person, that seems risky to me. What if breaking news happens on a Friday? Yes.
Do you know what's funny? This has been a problem for us for years. As you say, our production schedule is we tape the show in front of a live audience on Thursday nights, and we need to do that so we can have enough time to edit the show. The show is edited down from about sometimes as much as 2 hours to the, I think, 56 minutes that it is on the air. We need Friday to do that. That's a problem. What if something big happens on Friday? And we used to really worry about that. Sometimes we'd even record alternate takes because we didn't know how things were going to break. Is somebody going to be convicted or not? Are they going to shut down the government or not? These days, it's so overwhelming. We just know that some, like a half a dozen insane things are going to happen on Friday. And I think we just give up. We're like, at this point, you know, the news is like coming at us like a fire hose, although it's not water coming out. And as of 7:30 on Thursday night, I'm like, not my problem anymore, you know? And that it's almost a relief. To put it mildly, we have plenty to work with up until Thursday evening. So it's not as if we're lacking for material.
I like that. When in doubt, give up. Okay. So
exactly. You can come and see me in person just throwing up my hands going, not my problem anymore. Somebody else make up jokes about whatever happens tomorrow.
I read that they're now making Wait, Wait into a TV show. Are you going to be part of that?
Making it into a TV show is putting it way too strongly. Over the years, NPR tried twice to make a TV show out of NPR, one in 2008 and one in, I think, 2011 with CBS and BBC America, respectively, and nothing came of that. The BBC America version did make the air, the CBS version did not, and so NPR basically said, oh, doesn't work, works on public radio, doesn't work in TV, let's just move on with our lives. But about last year, some producers came and offered to try again. So all that's happened is those producers, independent people, have been given the option to try to develop a new Wait, Wait TV show. And that's all I know. NPR obviously owns the show. They're in control of whatever they want to do with it. And the rest of us, those of us who work in the radio show, are just getting up every day and doing the radio show and not worrying about it over much.
Okay, so let's learn about you. I mean, I learned a lot from your new book, The Incomplete Guide to Running, and I promise to ask you questions about your book in a little while, but I want to turn back the clock to how you got started. How does one end up in the host spot for a public radio quiz show? You don't exactly go to school for that.
No, no. Well, what I tell young people when they ask me for advice, if they could have a career as glorious as mine, is I say, well, do other things for your adult life, and then one day the phone will ring and offer you a job you're totally unqualified for. And when that happens, say yes. And that's not too much of an exaggeration. 20 years ago, when the show began, I was a playwright living in Brooklyn, going about my business, doing okay in that crazy field, when quite literally the phone rang. And it was a friend of mine said, I know somebody who's at NPR putting together a new show. They're looking for funny people who read a lot of newspapers. Are you interested? Well, of course I'm interested, because I was an NPR junkie at the time and imagined that, sure, I could go on NPR and gas on about stuff. How hard is that, right? And so I put in my name and I auditioned and I was cast as a panelist for the very first iteration of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which premiered in January, 21 years ago, almost exactly. And very shortly after that, they offered me the job of host, which I became in May of 98, and I've been doing it ever since. So like I said, vastly unqualified, very lucky.
So vastly unqualified, very lucky. What do you think the magic is? What makes you such a great host for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And I know you're blushing, but I still want you to answer.
I know. Well, I mean, I actually think it's my good looks, which I know is ironic since no
perfect
one can
for the
see
radio,
them.
Right.
But it just gives me that confidence and charm. I don't know. I will tell you that when you hear me on the radio talking to somebody and I sound interested in what that person has to say, whether it's one of our panelists or a special guest, I genuinely am. I really love talking to people and hearing what they have to say, whether it's a joke or a story from their lives. That makes me very happy. And if I have one, I don't know if I can say this on public radio, but you people are Maine. You're tough. I'm a smart ass. And that was kind of an obstacle growing up, that I always had a snarky or funny remark in otherwise serious times. An eminent theater director, Lloyd Richards of the formerly of the Yale School of Drama, once referred to me as an artist as the guy who's always picking his nose at the funeral. and that's sort of what I do. I'm always the guy who's like seeing the silly side of anything. And that apparently became my job, I guess. Lucky me. I don't know if I would have succeeded doing anything else. I would have annoyed everybody.
So if we heard the unedited version, would there be things that are not on the radio because they can't be on the radio?
Yes, there is. I mean, if there's any reason why people should pay money to come down and see us, which people do every week, it's for the what we like to think of as Wait, Wait After Dark. And our panelists and I and everybody knows that it's not live. And that means that we have a lot more freedom to try stuff. Some of that leads to brilliant off-the-cuff comments that nobody would have made if they felt restricted by anything. Some of it leads to material that we couldn't broadcast and stay in the air for another minute. So if you're interested in the kind of bluer aspect of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, I invite you all to come down and see a taping as soon as you can.
Okay, on to your book, The Incomplete Guide to Running. Peter, it's about running marathons, but really about much more. You write about going through a divorce, thinking about yourself as a fat kid, coming to terms with depression. Why did you decide to write the book and be so open about the kind of things other people keep to themselves?
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, I had no choice. And if anybody in your audience has ever written anything like this, they'll see what I mean. When I first signed a contract with the lovely people at Simon & Schuster to write a book, that was back in 2012. And at that time, it was going to be a very breezy, funny book about running. I had achieved a decent sort of career as an amateur runner, and I thought people might be interested in that. And then there were a number of explosions, one of which you've referred to, that of my marriage and my family. The other one was the Boston Marathon bombing, which I was at. I was 100 yards away. I had just finished the Boston Marathon at that time. And so those two explosions changed entirely the story that I wanted to tell. And when I sat down to write the book about running, I realized that I couldn't write about running, as I say at the beginning of the book, without writing about the rest of my life as well, particularly because, as it turns out, and this is something I didn't really understand until I was writing the book and even afterwards thinking about it, it turns out that all those miles of running marathons and training out there in the roads and the beaches and the trails of America and around the world, I kind of thought it was pointless. I mean, you know, I didn't get anywhere and all that running, but it turned out it wasn't. It turned out that it was very good training for what I ended up going through. So it all became part of the story.
You know, I didn't know your Boston Marathon story. I'm kind of embarrassed that I didn't because it appears you were all over the news in the next few days. Why don't you tell us?
I
mean,
you
were really, really, really close.
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre. I was at the Boston Marathon bombing, and I was also at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2011 when Barack Obama made fun of Donald Trump. So I've been near two tumultuous history-changing events. The short version is that I was in Boston guiding a blind runner named William Greer. I was asked to do that out of the blue, and I accepted it because of the other thing that was going on. My family life was rapidly disintegrating, and it seemed wise to get out of town. And we ran that race, the Boston Marathon, that day in 2013. Had a tough race, but thanks to William's gutsiness, he was having a very bad day, but at my urging decided he would run that last mile, you know, like a hero, like an Olympian. He did it. And because he did it, we crossed the line in good time, and we're sort of still, I guess, celebrating is too strong a word for people as tired as we were. Just 100 yards beyond the finish line when the bombs blew up right on the course side of the finish line, across the finish line from us. And the thing that makes it, well, more than just shocking, which is what it was at the time, is, like I said, William ran that last mile when he really didn't feel like it. He had had a very tough day. And if he hadn't run that mile, if he had walked it like he had wanted to, who knows where we would have been when the bombs went off.
Mm. I mean, talk about something to think about, mortality being so close.
Yes. Like I said, I ended up writing the book I was forced to write as opposed to the one I set out wanting to.
So even though you say you're not a big fan of running advice, you do have some advice in this book. And the first is to run with a group. I thought your insights on this were really interesting. Why do you think so many people resist running with a group? And why do you want them to get over it?
I think people resist running with a group because a few reasons. First of all, people have this vision, you know, in the phrase, the loneliness of the long-distance runner, that running is a solitary thing that you do. And for many people, it is. For me, it's been that way. I also think that people are kind of shy, especially when it comes to physical activity, i.e., if somebody is out of shape and somebody doesn't feel confident about themselves, which is true of many, many people, more than they might admit, the last thing they want to do is go out there and fail at something, be it running or anything else, with somebody watching them. And my argument is get over both those things. First of all, it's just like anything else in this life, it's better with company, especially when it gets hard. And secondly, accept that who you are, where you are, and when you are, don't be embarrassed of it, because when you go out to go running, even if you're out of shape, even if you've never run a step in your life, even if you don't think you can do it, by virtue of just putting on your old sneakers and running three blocks, you're already taking that first most important step of improving yourself, of changing your situation, of doing something about it. And that's not something to be ashamed of. That's something to be extraordinarily proud of. There's no shame in it. And what you will find if you join other people through a running group in your community or through a running store, wherever you might find them, is that everybody else is on the same journey. And because they're on the same journey, they are more than happy to help you and to receive your help and encouragement as well. It's the best thing ever.
I understand when you were here in Portland taping Wait, Wait a couple years ago, you did run with a group. And I want to know, was it the best group ever?
It was absolutely the best group ever, particularly because everybody had accents straight out of Bert and I. And it was amazing. I had always thought that that was a joke, but all we could talk about was, you know, getting down in the boat and going out there. You know, anyway, sorry, I promised somebody I'd make a Bert and I reference, and that was the first opportunity I had. No, I love going on the road and running with, well, strangers. It's a great way to meet people. For one thing, they're runners. They've showed up to go for a run for you. They probably don't have anything evil in mind. I don't think most serial killers are cardiovascularly fit. And the great thing about running with somebody is that it's a limited commitment, right? You know, you're going to be out there for half an hour to an hour with somebody. You can talk about anything. You don't have to worry about how you smell or how you look because nobody cares. And then it's over. And really, I'm somebody who's surprisingly, I guess, given my job, has some small level of social anxiety. And I find going running with people is a really stress-free way to spend time with them.
We're talking with Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and the author of the new book, The Incomplete Book of Running. If you have a question for Peter, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine Energy Audit and Insulation Rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
My most memorable car was a 65 powder blue Mustang named Dave.
Hi, I'm Paula Poundstone from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
One time, the brake pedal fell off and I couldn't have been happier because that, I know what it is. In fact, I kind of strutted about when I pulled in. I said, you know, you can look under the hood if you want to, but I believe you're going to find that the brake pedals come right off. Turn your car into the programs you love.
You can visit mainepublic.org and click on support. Maine Public has two paid summer internships available this summer for college or technical school students interested in careers in the news, journalism, digital news, technical, and broadcasting fields. Candidates for these Jim Dow internships should preferably be attending an institution based in Maine or have an existing connection to the state of Maine. For more information, please visit mainepublic.org and click on About and then Careers. or contact the Human Resources Department at 207-330-4506. Again, that number, 207-330-4506. Our application deadline is January 20th.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Peter Sagal, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, answers all of your questions in the form of a limerick. Joining me from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago is Peter Sagal. He is the author of The Incomplete Book of Running. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I will start with a question from Cindy. She says, what are your pet peeves when people call in?
I'm pretty easy when it comes with pet peeves, although there's one thing that people should never do when people call in to play our games is consider it an audition. We've never cast anyone on our show from the callers. We love our callers. A lot of people sometimes will sort of, I say, I'm going to go and wait, don't tell me, and I've got this joke, and I'm going to tell this joke, and it will make, I don't know what they want. But it generally doesn't work. So we are interested in just talking to you as you, not as a professional comedian. So I'll urge you to do that. Other than that, I'm pretty easygoing. I have the best job in the world. I don't spend any time worrying about the drawbacks.
I'll go to Ava, who's calling from York, Maine. Hi, Ava. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling with Peter Sagal.
Hi, so nice to chat. I don't even have an accent because I'm at the southern tip. Okay, my question really is, well, first of all, I must say, vastly unqualified and very lucky, if I can paraphrase what you said earlier, as a career coach, that is something I really love. And I think that happens to a lot of people. They fall into something and it works out. So congratulations on that. I wait for the show. I don't want anyone around me. I put the radio up very loudly. And then again, on Sunday, if it's a tremendous show, I listen once again. So I think it's amazing.
Well, thank you. It's
funny. And really, at all times, I think humor is it. And I will say, as a side note, the current D.C. situation is giving you such topical stuff. I mean, the president just keeps on giving. But anyway.
He's generous that way.
Isn't he?
He is a good man.
My dad was a runner in the 1960s, and we lived in Andover, about a half hour from Boston, and it was his life goal to be in the Boston Marathon. But people would ask him, what are you doing? What are you running? Because it just was never seen. And he was an attorney by trade. So I give you credit. I think he did it to de-stress. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
if I can comment, what's interesting is the cover of my book, The Complete Book of Running, or rather The Incomplete Book of Running, is in fact a very direct homage to a book by Jim Fix called The Complete Book of Running. And Jim, who's deceased, was part of that generation that was running around in the 60s, and nobody had any notion what they were doing out there. Because until Jim Fix wrote and published his book in the late 70s, nobody really thought of running as something that you just do for itself. People who practiced running were either trying to win running races, 100-yard dashes or 10,000-meter races, or they were training for something else, like boxing maybe or football. The idea of just running for its own sake was entirely new, and Jim Fix introduced that concept. And if you go back and read his book, which I recommend after you read mine, you'll see this tone of like, let me tell you, everybody, about this amazing thing that you can do that will solve all of your problems, which is an exaggeration. It won't solve all of them, but it'll make them a little more manageable. So, yeah, people who were out there running in the 60s, people just thought they were nuts.
Ava, before we let Peter go, do you have a question for him?
Yes. Well, I just wanted to say I understand the homage because the five children gave my father that book one year by Jim Fix for Father's Day, and we thought we did the best job instead of a tie or cologne, and he did love the book. And so that was going to be my question. Did you read Jim Fix's book, and is it So incomplete or complete based on that. And the last thing, I'm just going to give a tidbit. In the future, I don't know how old you are, but my husband has been a runner for over 40 years, but he's 6'6". Prolotherapy is now what he's into for his knee. So I go and caution you, but enjoy the running, because I think it fixes a lot of things for people. And congratulations
well,
on your book.
Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. And yeah, I'm all about Gym Fix. And if you read the book, there's a whole chapter about that book and its influence on me and my father and that whole generation. So in fact, I just recently heard from Gym Fix's son, who I owe a book to.
Thank you, Ava, for your call. We have an email from Dre. I'd like to know if your lightning-fast wit and your sense of humor was cultivated by your parents and any of your siblings as a kid, although I realize that it just has to be innate. Fun.
Yeah, thank you for the compliment there. My father claims both credit for it, and my brother, my older brother, claims that he's funnier than I am. Both of them are wrong. Although I will tell you that the funniest person in my family is my younger brother, who is a lawyer in Western Colorado, who I think has the darkest and most mordant wit of anybody. But no, basically, my story, I think, is very typical of stand-up comedians, if you get to know any of them, or comedy writers in general, which is that there are some people who just don't find their way through the world at a young age. They're not athletes. They're not at ease. They don't have the kind of self-confidence that allows them to just, you know, stroll the halls of a school and feel cool. So we make up for it with jokes, because the funny thing about a joke is if you tell a joke and somebody laughs, you know for that instant they're happy to see you. So for a lot of us, I include myself, it was a way of covering up sort of basic insecurities. And it, you know, it turns out it's also a viable career path.
Trish wants to know, who is your dream celebrity call-in? Who do you really want on the show?
It's funny. For many, many years, people would ask me that question, and I always say the same thing. It would be Elvis Costello, who is sort of my musical god, right? I grew up listening to him, changed my life. I've seen him in concert 30 or 40 times. And then we got Elvis Costello in the show, so now I don't know what to say. These days, I feel like I'd love to have George W. Bush on the show. We've had now 4 presidents to make fun of on Wait, Wait, and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama have been on the show. George W. Bush, we spent 8 years making fun of him, and I think he deserves an absolute chance to give us some back. As to the 4th president, we'll see about that. But so if anybody knows George W. Bush, I know he has a strong family connection to Maine. So if anybody listening there knows how to get in touch with him, tell him we'd love to talk to him anytime.
And I hear he's got a great sense of humor. So,
yeah, what's interesting, if I can wax a little serious for a second, like I said, we made fun of Barack Obama, we made fun of Bill Clinton, we'd make fun of George W. Bush. And all 3 of those men, whatever you might think of them, had senses of humor about themselves. And for that reason, never minded it when people like me made fun of them, or far more prominent people like Stephen Colbert or Jay Leno or whomever. They've, in fact, both George W. Bush and Bill Clinton have said that explicitly. Oh, no, I never minded the jokes. They were funny. Both of them, George H.W. Bush did this too, invited the people who made fun of them on Saturday Night Live to come to events with him at the White House. They thought it was delightful. And I think that speaks well of them. And it's also the way it should be. People like me should not affect people like them. The people who are making those decisions shouldn't have to worry about what some guy on public radio is going to say about him if they make a funny decision. They should be thinking about the good of the country. And I think that you can tell what happens if the president does take people like me a little too seriously, thus proving my point.
An email from Mimi. Please tell Peter that no matter how down I feel, Wait, Wait never fails to cheer me up mightily.
I love to hear that. People, when we do our show in Chicago, we can't really afford to do it on the road. There's too many people. But in our theater in Chicago, we always meet everybody who wants to meet us after the show. And sometimes it's as many as 50 or to 100 people. And they come up and they say hello and they get an autograph. And I get to talk to them. And I hear that all the time, that we cheer them up or we help them get it through a hard week. Sometimes we hear that it helped people get through a sickness or the death of a loved one or a loss of a job or a divorce or any other sort of hard thing. And I have come to feel that that role that I play by giving people just a break, by cheering them up if only for an hour, is in fact, a rare and wonderful privilege. And I'm very glad to be able to do it for people.
We'll go to Carol, who's calling from Starks. Hi, Carol. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a little bit of credibility. I've finished 7 marathons, 2 Boston officials, and 1 the women's division of the Dartmouth Marathon. But now I'm 74.
That's a lot of credibility.
And, my best time was 3:14:59 at Maine Coastal, where it goes right by the Bush family compound, which was really kind of excellent.
Oh, really? Did the Bushes come out and wave?
No, but they didn't have security or anything. I could see their whole compound and kind of wave at it myself. It was great. I wanted to thank you for mentioning how the training miles are the ones where, I mean, I solved all of my emotional problems in my training miles. Now I have to walk at the gym or on the icy roads of Maine or go snowshoeing. But I really did get through a divorce and all sorts of other, you know, the factors of life. I'm 74, like I said. So those miles were not useless. In fact, I preferred them to the events like the marathon.
Yeah. I know. It's amazing. But yeah, but go on, please.
No, it's just that it gives you that kind of, it's a different kind of meditation because I can't just sit still for that amount of time. But I can be out for an hour or two on the roads or on my snowshoes, and all of my problems get processed kind of automatically, and I come home and I've got my answers. It's just sort of remarkable. So it's never been a struggle. It's always been a joy.
It's great. In fact, of the things that I've said in the book and have been repeated or excerpted in various publications, the most controversial is when I said you shouldn't run wearing headphones. And people rise up and go, what are you talking about? We can't spend a half hour, an hour without something in our ears. And as the caller just proved, yes, you can. And not only can you should, because we spend all our days these days with input. I say this knowingly on the radio that people are listening to, presumably. But I think it's really important that we cut that off and just listen to our own thoughts for a while. That used to be the human condition of just being able to sit and think and muse, for better or for worse, about where you are and where you need to go. We never let ourselves do that anymore. And going for a run, be it for 15 minutes, half an hour, however, going outside and just letting yourself think is perhaps one of the best bits of self-care that we can do for ourselves these days.
Carol, thanks for your call. We have an email from Richard, a couple that are similar to this one as well. Peter should run the Millinocket Marathon. Last one was December 8th, 2018. I'm assuming the next one is around the same time in December 2019. Wear frostbite gear, of course. You live in Chicago. The Millinocket Marathon in December should be nothing for you.
Right. Well, it is true that you Mainers are tough, I know, but a marathon in December in Maine, I imagine the footing would be great. One of the nice things about running is there's always something to do. There, of course, is races all summer. There are races all winter. There's a very popular half marathon that goes off in a week here in Chicago called the F3. One of the Fs is frozen. I won't tell you what the other two Fs are. It's great. It's fun because we call it an endurance sport, and a lot of times people come up with more things to endure, and I'm all for that.
We'll go to Chad, who's calling from Winslow. Hi, Chad. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Jennifer. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
I have a non-running related question.
Sure.
I've been listening to Wait. Since the first show, and I have always been impressed with the content and the intelligent humor. I mean, everywhere you go nowadays, people think that being vulgar is funny. But I listen to you guys every week, and it cracks me up. It literally, I'm falling out of my chair. It's that good. And the one question, and maybe this is a trade secret that you don't want to answer.
Yes. All right.
Do you write all of your own material, or do you have help?
I am proud to say and grateful to say that I have help. When the show began, I did a lot of the writing on my own. But as things developed, and this is not a coincidence, as the show got better, we added a lot of very talented people over the years. And right now, the show is written by myself, along with my producers Mike Danforth, Miles Dernboss, Jennifer Mills, Lillian King, and Ian Chillog. And all of us get together all week. And if you've ever written comedy or worked in a place that needs to do it, you understand that comedy is one of those things that tends to work better when done in a group, because you riff on each other. Because I'll come up with a joke, and it's not a very good joke, but maybe Ian or Jennifer will say, you know what's funnier is this, and we'll punch it. And it becomes our story meetings, our editorial meetings, are like funny conversations around a dinner table. We try to crack each other up, and we're reacting to each other, and that leads to a much better product. So a lot of times when I land a joke on the show, you have no way of knowing if it was my joke or someone else's joke. It took me a while to get used to that. I used to be a writer myself and took pride that everything I wrote, I actually wrote. But, you know, I'm out there representing the whole show in the same way that Stephen Colbert does and, you know, John Oliver does. And I'm absolutely proud to, be the vehicle through which these delightful people get their ideas into the world.
Chad, thank you for your call. We're going to take another quick break, but first, a word about tomorrow's show. We're going to be broadcasting from the Augusta Civic Center, where the Maine State Agricultural Trade Show is taking place. When we return, more of your questions for Peter Sagal. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And Fader Lee Law, dedicated to providing effective counsel on all matters of land use and real estate in Maine. Learn more at FaderLeeLawMaine.com.
Federal workers and contractors who haven't gotten paid are cutting back where they can on family expenses. Some are trying to explain that to their kids.
Mommy doesn't have money right now. I can't get that right now. I'm not getting a paycheck. And he's like, but you go to work, Mom.
I'm Ari Shapiro, the financial lives of furloughed workers, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening right here on Maine Public Radio. Coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, we'll have ideas from the CBC. Today's topic is, why is environmentalism failing? That's ideas from the CBC this afternoon at 2 o'clock, right here on the listener-supported stations of Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the host of the wildly popular Saturday news show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Excuse me, news quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Peter Sagal is on the line with us. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We have a tweet from Nyssa. Is Peter proud of his brief career of modeling knitted zombie hats? Would he sign my copy of said knitting pattern if I were ever to run into him in public? Peter, I did some research before this program, but I didn't come across anything about knitted zombie hats.
This is because of my dear friend Kyle Cassidy, who's a very busy and successful and talented photographer, who, among other things, took the photo on the cover of my book. He also photographed my wedding. And Kyle is doing 100 projects at once, and he did a book called Geek Knits, in which he presented, or he took photographs for a book called Geek Knits, in which a woman whose name I apologize, I can't remember, likes to knit things for geeky pursuits and geeky people. And thus, I was enlisted as a model by Kyle to demonstrate their zombie apocalypse knitwear with some of my friends as zombies, which was even better. And I got to say, if you grow up and, you know, you're not known for your good looks, basically all you want to be in life is a fashion model. So that was a dream come true, even though if it was zombie related, hey, I'll take it.
Kara on Facebook.
And yes, if you find me with that book, I will so sign that picture with pride.
Well, this is kind of a related question. Kara on Facebook says, will the show be traveling to New England this year?
We've gotten into the habit of doing shows on the regular at Tanglewood. That seems to work out really well for us. Big crowds show up. Obviously, it's sort of central-ish New England. People come there from Vermont, New Hampshire. It's a bit of a drive from Maine. But that has been our New England stop for the last few years. I wouldn't be surprised if in the next year or so we also come up and do a show where you are, or at least a little closer, perhaps New Hampshire or Boston. But I'm not in charge, sadly. I go where they tell me. But I remember our one show in Portland really fondly, especially for the lobster we got.
An email from Dan. I make all my Saturday morning errands centered around the time Wait, Wait is on the air. I think Peter is the most underrated comic wit in the entertainment business. He could do late night comedy with the best of them. Any desire to give that a shot?
You know, I just don't think so. For one thing, and, you know, let's just be honest, I have a face made for radio.
Oh.
Secondly, those guys work really hard. I mean, I know some of the people who work on those shows, and it's incredibly difficult to create that kind of material. And I'll say one last thing. And first of all, I appreciate the compliment. I don't want to, like, brush it off. That's very kind of you to say, although I'm not quite sure I agree. One of the great things about my life is the exact level of fame that I have, which is moderate to low and very specific. Because I'm on the radio, I can walk around most days and nobody has any idea who I am, which is nice. But then I also have this experience of, like, going out on a stage and saying, hey, it's me. And people go, yay, we like you, which is also nice. And the fact that those people are all public radio people who are, by definition, the nicest people, makes it a win-win situation. I know some really famous people, and their lives are not that great sometimes. It's hard for them to go out, for example. And so I'm very happy doing what I do with the people I do it with and for the people we're doing it for.
We'll go to Lawton, who's calling from Penobscot, Maine. Hi, Lawton. Go ahead.
Hello there. Hey,
hi.
You're a funny man, mister.
Why, thank you.
I'm just wondering, do you and the other panelists, do you do some kind of jocular exercises before the show to get worked up? I mean, how do you...
I love the idea. Jocular exercising. You know, we're all shouting, like, cross the chicken. Why did the chicken cross the road? No, we don't. It's very funny. If you were to come and hang out with us before the show, you'd find a bunch of people who are all very friendly, having a dinner, right? We always, you know, and we chat up, we catch up with our families or recent vacations, what you've been up to since last time I saw you. We go over some of the show stuff. The panelists all write the bluff stories themselves. We go over that. Oh, did you know, is it too long or did you emphasize the right thing? We do that. But that's it. And then we just go out on stage. The panel has no idea what I'm going to ask them about. So they're all improvisational. I have no idea how they're going to respond. So that's improvisational. So it really is unprepared. And I think that, again, is another aspect of why we're popular. Because those late night shows, they do brilliant work, but it's very written, very carefully produced for maximum entertainment. And that's great. What John Oliver does, brilliant. We do something different. We have an actual improvisational show where we're making it up as we go. And through careful editing that removes the bad bits, it genuinely sounds like it's happening in the moment because it really is. And I think that's part of our appeal.
Lawton, thanks for your call. We'll move to Marty, who's calling from South Portland. Hi, Marty. Go ahead.
Hi. A long-time listener to your show, both Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and to... this one here, and I just love both of them. Couple quick observations. One of my favorite things about listening to, like, late-night talk show hosts like Johnny Carson, he would save the key word for the end. He'd lead you one way, and then one word would also wrench you off in another direction, which leads to an observation that I hold to heart. I firmly believe that wit is intellect dancing. And I was wondering if you'd like
nice
to comment
phrase.
On that. And
I've spent.
Did you hear what you said?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I've spent a little amount of time thinking about how humor works. It's my business, you know. And certainly the thing that you say is absolutely true is that humor relies on a lot of things, but it relies on surprise. You know, the idea that I'm going to start a sentence and when I finish it, the last thing I'm going to say is something you didn't expect, is basically how every joke in the world works. Because if you knew what I was going to say, it wouldn't be funny. If I just said something that, you know, if I just said, goodness, I think that the president might be, you know, too close to Vladimir Putin, that's not a joke. But, you know, maybe if I say, well, you know, the president is interested in things Russian because if you were to open him up, there'd be a smaller version of him inside. Maybe that's a joke, you know, and not a very good one, apparently. But the whole notion of humor is surprise, is to show you or tell you something that you didn't see coming. So yeah, one of the things we got to do when we start writing the show is we got to get through all the things that are easy. I read a statement from David Chase, the creator of The Sopranos, and he said, you know, when you're writing a show like ours, you got to throw out your first 10 ideas, because those are going to be influenced by other people or things you've seen or things you've already done or things that you know works, and that's not interesting. If you're going to make something new and really compelling, it has to be entirely new. And that same thing works for writing jokes. Sometimes, here, I'll give you an example. This was way back when Sarah Palin was in the news. And she used some word, disestablishmenting or something. And people have been making fun of that misspeaking for all week. And we didn't know what to say about it. We felt we should, because it was a prominent speech. And we tried so many different jokes, and none of them worked or were interesting. And finally, Ian Chillog, one of our producers, literally an hour before the show went on the air, said, you know, the problem with Sarah Palin is she would have used a thesaurus, but she thinks they're all extinct. That's a good joke. And it took about 3 days to get there. That's how it works, I'm afraid.
Things have to compost a while sometimes.
Yeah, as it were. Yes, they have to start smelling, you know, generating their own heat before they're ready to use.
Marty, thanks for your call. Jill on Facebook says, "What joke or story have you done that got you in the most trouble?"
There are jokes that I've told that I'm proud of that got me in a little bit of trouble. We told one about Donald Trump last year. It was about the revelation of what we now call the Trump Tower meeting. That turns out that Don Jr., his son, had this meeting with these Russians to talk about interference with the election, and he lied about it. And I got up in front of a national radio audience and I said, poor Donald Trump, he'd always wanted to be screwed by one of his children, but not that one. And the audience went, ooh. And the broadcast audience went, ooh. And some people wrote in and were like, how could you say that about the president? And we said, well, we can say that about the president because he said this half a dozen times about himself, i.e., if Ivanka wasn't my daughter, I'd date her. So we felt pretty good about that joke. To be slightly more serious, one of the things I've learned through failure is that, remember I said that we're supposed to cheer people up? It doesn't cheer people up if we make jokes about things that people just don't find very funny. Many, many years ago, I learned this lesson when I made some jokes about the death of Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter, because I thought I had some jokes. I thought there were some funny things to say. But what I found out was that people really didn't think that was funny. People weren't ready to laugh about that. People wrote into me and they said, you know, I understand your job is to make jokes, but you have to understand that show meant a lot to us. My children loved that guy. They're having a hard time coping with his death. He was a good guy. It's not fun. And I realized, yeah, you know, I have a responsibility to the public. If I do something and people find it offensive or sad, I don't get to say, well, the problem is you people don't have a sense of humor. No, I need to know what people are ready to laugh at. And that's part of the gig.
We'll go to Davey calling from Portland. Hi, Davey. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. This is way exciting. I usually listen to Maine Calling when I'm driving. And if I want to call in or shout about something that somebody has said, I can't because I'm driving. But this is exciting. Thank you very much. I learned from my Flemish friends when I lived in Belgium. They said humor is conquered grief. And it's what I do every morning, Tuesday through Friday, listening to the wrap-up of the late night. But then, of course, there's Saturday and wait, don't tell me. My question is that having moved here from San Francisco as a victim of the housing situation there, I would like to go trotting around with my border collie in Portland. And I'm wondering where or how I should start that. And is it about the shoes or how would I just take my first steps?
Well, Davey, I think that you have a question Peter would love to answer because I read his book and I know how he feels about shoes or shoe advice.
It's one of the great things about running is that there is no threshold for entry. You don't need to buy equipment. You don't need to join a gym. Good shoes will do you in good stead eventually, but you don't need them. You got a pair of sneakers, old tennis shoes maybe, whatever. Walking shoes, go out, use them, put them on. You don't need special clothes. Put on a sweatsuit if it's cold. Put on shorts if it's not. and go for a run. Just do it. Don't say to yourself, oh, I need to have this, or I need to have Under Armour clothing, or I need to have technical. No, just go. And as you do it, and as you fall into it, you'll find out what works best for you. Eventually, you probably want to go to a real running store, not a chain, but you know, an independent running store that knows about runners and can look at you and help you find your right shoe. That helps a lot. But everything else is optional. The most important thing is to start, and everything else follows after that. Don't think that you need to do anything. Just go.
Davey, thanks for your call. We have an email from Debbie. My kids and I were at the Portland taping a few years ago and still have my Carl Castle face on a stick. I believe it was one of his last shows. We were in the last row of the balcony, but loved every minute. Carl Castle's gone now, but I'm wondering how his spirit lives on with you and the others on the cast and the staff.
Carl, of course, we did lose Carl this year after his retirement from the show 4 years ago, almost five now. And his spirit lives on entirely in our show. He was, when he was with our show, the heart and soul of it. He was the one element of the show that was stable, that the show started with him. Carl was the kindest person I've ever met. In the years that I knew him, 15 years or so, he never said a harsh word about anybody. He never complained, and he went about his business with us with a sense of gratitude that he felt he was so lucky to be able to get up and do this show with us for you. And I, whenever I'm feeling a little frustrated, like, oh, I wish I didn't have that, I just remember that. I say, you know, be grateful that you get to get up and do this and speak into a microphone and people want to hear you. So that kind of kindness and gratitude, that we owe to Carl.
And Peter, we just have a few seconds left, and I'll let you talk about Bill Curtis, because Carl had big shoes to fill, but I think that he's done a pretty good job.
Yes. Carl can never be replaced, but he can be succeeded. And if people don't know who Bill Curtis is, Bill Curtis is literally a giant of broadcasting. I guess that would mean he'd have to be like 8 feet tall. No, he's just a giant of broadcasting. His voice is incredibly well-known from news, let me put it this way, to be very brief. He narrates the movie Anchorman, which most people know, you know, back in the day, before cable. That's him. But what most people don't know is that he actually was one of the models for Ron Burgundy. Not the ludicrous silliness, but the idea that there was one guy who an entire city turned to for the news. That was Bill Curtis for many, many years. And so I am sharing the stage with an absolute legend every time I do the show with him.
Well, Peter, I think you're a legend as well. That's Peter Sagal. He is the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Such a treat to have you on the program today. Peter is also an author, and his latest book is The Incomplete Guide to Running. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. As mentioned, tomorrow we will be on the road at the Augusta Civic Center for the annual Maine State Agricultural Trade Show. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.